Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Tracy McClure with you over the next half hour. Thanks for joining me. Coming up on the program, our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading and Joan Knows. Joan Lewis looks over the past week's events here in the Vatican and shares her insider knowledge of the special relationship between Mother Teresa of Calcutta and Pope John Paul II. Let's start off now with Jill Bevilacqua, who reflects on the Sunday Gospel reading in her series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
On one occasion, when a great crowd was with Jesus, he turned to them and said, If anyone comes to me without turning his back on his father and mother, his wife and his children, his brothers and sisters, indeed his very self, he cannot be my follower. Anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. If one of you decides to build a tower, will he not first sit down and calculate the outlay to see if he has enough money to complete the project? He will do that for fear of laying the foundation and then not being able to complete the work, at which all who saw it would then jeer at him, saying, That man began to build what he could not finish. Or if a king is about to march on another king to do battle with him, will he not sit down first and consider whether with 10,000 men he can withstand an enemy coming against him with 20,000? If he cannot, he will send a delegation while the enemy is still at a distance, asking for terms of peace. In the same way, none of you can be my disciple if he does not renounce all his possessions.
As we follow Luke's gospel in these Sundays of ordinary time, we're also following our Lord on his journey to Jerusalem, his last journey. As a biblical scholar writes, Jerusalem, for Luke, has an important role. His gospel begins and ends in the temple. Furthermore, the central part of the work has as its background the journey of Jesus to Jerusalem. This central part runs from the middle of chapter 9 to the middle of chapter 19. Our gospel today is taken from the last part of chapter 14. It's winter time. Late January, probably, or early February, of the year 30. Jesus spends a good part of these last 3 months of his life in Perea, Herod's territory, to the east of the Jordan. But at some point, he crosses back into Galilee, because we read later of his healing of 10 lepers along the border between Samaria and Galilee. We may imagine him then somewhere to the north of that border, perhaps crossing the broad green valley of Jezreel in Lower Galilee. And if he looked over to the mountains on his right, he might well have seen Nazareth, his hometown. But if we recall the gospel of a couple of months ago, his face was set towards Jerusalem. So there's no looking back, no time for nostalgia. And to the great crowd which is surrounding him, he speaks uncompromising words. Our gospel version today gives a somewhat easier translation of the word usually rendered as hate.
If any man comes to me without hating his father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, yes, and his own life too, he cannot be my disciple.
The word hate in the original was a Hebraism, we're told, an emphatic way of expressing a total detachment. Another scholar writes that the word hate, meaning to love less well, is opposed to prefer. Hebrew had no comparatives. And Jesus meant that anyone who wished to follow him must prefer him to every other person and all worldly possessions. But what about hating one's life and carrying the cross? Peter and the other apostles had abandoned their families in order to follow him. And in Matthew, there's a question from Peter which suggests that they had sometimes wondered what would be their reward for this sacrifice.
What about us? He said to him. We have left everything and followed you. What are we to have then? Jesus said to him, I tell you solemnly, when all is made new and the Son of Man sits on his throne of glory, You will yourselves sit on 12 thrones to judge the 12 tribes of Israel, and everyone who's left houses, brothers, sisters, father, mother, children, or land for the sake of my name will be repaid 100 times over and also inherit eternal life.
The words used in today's version of the gospel about the cross are, "Anyone who does not take up his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Indeed, we can't carry a cross without taking it up. And in the year 1095, a French pope made a spectacular offer. In proclaiming the First Crusade, Urban II declared that all those who took the cross and confessed their sins would be given remission from all suffering in purgatory. It was the first plenary indulgence. A crusader who died in a state of grace then was guaranteed entry into heaven. Volunteers to take part in this holy war were enrolled by a vow and received a small cross. The cross also appeared on their dress, while the word crusader itself came from the Latin crux, for cross, and the French croix. Croisade, crusade, came from an earlier word, croisé, which meant literally the state of being marked with the cross. To take the cross, then, in medieval times, was to take the pledge to become a crusader. Originally, there were ideas of chivalry as well as hopes of material gain, but the movement degenerated from being a holy venture till it was discredited altogether. In particular, after the Fourth Crusade, when against the Pope's directives, the Crusaders marched on Constantinople, second city of Christendom, sacking it, burning, plundering, and seizing all Byzantine churches. Innocent III, who had preached this crusade, wrote to Cardinal Peter of Capua.
How will the Greek Church be brought back to unity and her devotion to the Apostolic See renewed? The Latins have given an example only of perversity and works of darkness. These soldiers of Christ are drenched in Christian blood.
The eighth and last crusade ended in 1272. But long before that, taking the cross had become a travesty of the Christian symbol. We're not told of any reaction by the crowd when Jesus stated the requirements for discipleship, but there must have been a reaction and a muttering and shaking of heads as if to say, what does he mean, leave everything, everyone? And Jesus, as always, explains by giving practical, everyday examples. He sees the enthusiasm, but he pours cold water on impetuous, unthinking decision. We cannot choose a way of life without reflection, without asking ourselves, can we go through with it? And he uses the parable of the tower. Scholars suggest he's probably referring to the towers country people used to build for two purposes, as storehouses for their implements and for produce, and as lookout posts to keep watch for thieves and prowling animals. Usually they were simple enough and roofed only with earth, but they could be stone. Matthew refers to such a tower in the parable of the vineyard owner. A man of some property would be prepared to spend a bit in order to protect it, hence the reference to calculating the outlay. A tower, in its simplest idea, is a fabric for defence against enemies, as Cardinal Newman comments. Every castle had its tower. But in past times, even church towers could be defensive. They were solid and strongly built, so that archers could shoot their arrows without fear of being hit themselves. They were also used as lookout posts on which warning beacons were lit. Churches were often built on hilltops, so they could be reached easily by the local people when seeking refuge in times of war or other upheaval. Some towers were detached from the church. Perhaps, it's been suggested, so the people could take refuge there and the tower could be defended without damaging the church. The primary object of the church tower, of course, was to house the bells, which is why it had to be very strong. And the windows of the tower allowed the notes of the bells to radiate. However, not everyone appreciates church towers. Daniel Defoe, known chiefly for his novel Robinson Crusoe, wrote a guidebook called Tour Through the Whole Island of Great Britain. And writing of Winchester Cathedral in 1724, he had nothing good to say.
The outside of the church is as plain and coarse as if the founders had abhorred ornaments. It has no steeple, but a short tower covered flat, as if the top of it had fallen down, and it had been covered in haste to keep the rain out till they had time to build it up again.
One of the most celebrated of church towers must surely be the bell tower, or campanile, of St. Mark's in Venice. But on a fateful morning in July 1902, the tower of St. Mark fell down. Jan Morris tells the story.
Early that July morning, this famous tower gave a gentle shudder, shook itself, and slowly, gently, almost silently, collapsed. Not a soul was hurt. A hillock of rubble filled the corner of the piazza, and a cloud of dust rose high above the city, like a pillar of guidance, or a shroud. But the only casualty was a tabby cat, which had been removed to safety from the custodian's lodge, but imprudently returned to finish its victuals. The weather-vane angel, pitched into the piazza, landed at the door of the basilica, and this was regarded as a miraculous token that the great church would not be damaged. Nor was it. When the dust had cleared and the loose masonry had subsided, there was seen to be lying unbroken on the debris the Marangona, the senior bell of Venice, which had called the people to their duties for six centuries. Even half a dozen shirts, which the custodian's wife had been ironing the day before, were found as good as new under the wreckage.
The loss of St. Mark's Tower was mourned worldwide, but the money came pouring in, and 9 years later, the campanile rose again, modernized, 600 tons lighter, but looking almost the same as before. Thousands of pigeons carried the news of its inauguration to every Italian city, and at the festive banquet, six of the guests wore the very shirts that had been rescued from the debris. The second parable Jesus uses to make his point might seem surprising, out of character almost, but he's a realist, and the history of Israel, as recounted in the Old Testament, is studded with battles. So he chooses an image his listeners would understand. When the enemy has superior forces, it is wise to sue for peace. I'm reminded of Shakespeare's Henry V, in which the French army is far larger than the English, but when the French herald comes to suggest that Henry buy his ransom, the English king refuses, while admitting his forces are weaker.
We would not seek a battle as we are, nor as we are, we say, we will not shun it.
That night, the two armies are camped opposite each other, and while the English sit patiently by their watchful fires and inly ruminate the morning's danger,
the confident and overlusty French do the low-rated English play at dice.
As 0 hour approaches, Henry prays.
O God of battles, steel my soldiers' hearts, possess them not with fear. Take from them now the sense of reckoning, if the opposed numbers pluck their hearts from them.
Henry's prayer is answered, and the field of Agincourt is won, as the French herald has to admit, the day is yours. Courage or rashness, depending on your point of view, has had the better of prudence here. In 1944, as the Allies were preparing for D-Day, a film of Henry V was made, with the express purpose of instilling courage into the troops. Today the scene may be different, but the armies are still unequal, and the words of the heralds, the delegations, still fall on deaf ears, as the psalmist lamented.
I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for fighting.
To follow Jesus, to build the kingdom of God, concludes the scholar, we must reflect, be aware, and even abandon the things which hold sway over us, like possessions. Put like that, it's an invitation to freedom.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. And before concluding today's show, we take a look back at the events in the Vatican over the past week with Joan Lewis, EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief, who sat down with me in studio. Come join us. Hi again, Joan. It's great to have you here again in studio. There's been a lot of things going on.
Oh my gosh, what a week.
The Pope's been very busy.
We could speak nonstop for an hour, and we might have covered some of it, is about what it's a question of. I think we should highlight what we're in the midst of really right now, the weekend.
The canonization
exactly.
of Mother Teresa of Calcutta.
Exactly. But it's a weekend that combines two events, that canonization, and you will see the blue and white saris of all the missionaries of charity all over Rome. But so that's a big event, but it's also linked to another event that was on the Jubilee calendar long before Mother's canonization was announced, and that is the Jubilee of Missionaries of Mercy and of Volunteers. So that's a three-day event beginning Friday. Lots of things on their agenda. Saturday, a big catechesis in St. Peter's Square. Then, of course, Sunday, the Mass with the principal purpose of the canonization. And, of course, on Thursday, interestingly enough, they put up the beautiful tapestry of Mother Teresa. And Cardinal Comastri said that normally it's only put up maybe the day before, maybe two, but he just felt that this was so important in this year of mercy to have the tapestry of Mother Teresa up early. The missionaries of charity, the nuns, are organizing events all over Rome to commemorate Mother. Monday, of course, there will be, as there always is after a canonization, there will be a mass of Thanksgiving.
Cardinal Parolin.
The Secretary of State, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's outdoors in St. Peter's Square. But, you know, there have been symposiums, there have been art exhibits, there have been concerts, and will be as we speak at this moment. So a huge weekend, which you can see just by the crowds in Rome.
An interesting thing, I learned that at the United Nations, there's also going to be an exhibit on Mother Teresa organized by the Vatican Mission to the UN.
And that would certainly be no surprise. I mean, she received the Nobel Peace Prize. She has addressed the UN. This is a woman whose holiness was visible in her lifetime.
What about the special relationship between her and John Paul II? Do any episodes, any particular times in their lifetime that you can recall?
I think that with Mother Teresa and John Paul, I don't even think they ever had to speak to each other. Of course they did. But they innately knew and understood each other's love for humanity, the greatness, the bigness, the depth of their soul, of their love for their fellow man. And just to see the two of them together, and how often you'd see them holding hands. He would help her down some stairs or up some stairs or something. There was just this love and respect and esteem. You know, we don't use the word adoration that often for people, but I think you could almost use it with the two of them. Just a symbiosis of their feelings. They just knew each other inside and out without even talking, because their gestures, in the Pope's case, gestures and words, homilies, speeches, everything else. But in Mother Teresa's case, her gestures said who she was, being with the dying. And she told volunteers, if you can't put a smile on your face, don't go to see the dying. Do something else that day. So even when she had her dark moments of the soul, as they were called, and people only learned about really after her death, even in those dark moments, the one thing she could always manage, and always did manage, was a smile. And you look at John Paul, who certainly didn't want to give up the papacy. He knew God would take him when the moment was right. And that's what God did. And when God did that, he allowed us to watch this man over a period of years, then months, weeks, and days. We were allowed to watch a man die with dignity and grace. Well, and I'm sure that's exactly how her death was, too. But just a commonality among the two. You felt holiness. You felt saintliness when you were near them. You just knew it. And they knew that in each other.
So let's go back then and take a look at the Sunday Angelus from the past week.
Obviously, life did go on. The Angelus, the Holy Father, principally focused on the victims of the earthquake that had happened. So Sunday was the 28th. The earthquake, of course, had been August 24th. And he offered many words of encouragement, obviously, to the people. And he had an appeal for prayerful and concrete solidarity. And he also, of course, said this was kind of the headline of the Angelus, that he wanted to visit as soon as possible. But he specifically mentioned the four towns most damaged by this, with the greatest loss of life and the most damage. So Amatrice, Accumoli, Arquata del Tronto, and Norcia. So the Pope did say, I want to come and see you as soon as possible. And that can be any time. He wants to go before the end of the Year of Mercy. But you have to look at the logistics. Getting there, would he go by car? Would he'd have to visit part of it by helicopter. He'd want to see people undoubtedly say a mass. So the first funeral was held for 35 victims. Actually, they were all from one town. So 35 of the total people of, I think we're now at or very near 300. They were buried then. And then Sunday at the Angelus, and he did talk about the September 1st World Day of Prayer for the Care of Creation. And this day was actually begun in 1989 under the leadership of the Orthodox Church. We know Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople is very big on that. And then he actually established this day for the Catholic Church, because other churches have participated, with a letter dated August of last year, and called for this celebration. And then he did have a message come out for the World Day of Prayer for the Care of Creation. And actually, if anything comes out of that message, I think one of the main headlines in the media was that the Pope has asked for a new work of mercy, caring for our common home, the planet, and all its inhabitants. And the Pope has now asked for us to care for our common home, the planet, the earth, God's creation. This is more or less addressed to, as he says, every person living on the planet, about the sufferings of the poor and the devastation of the environment. And he says we just can't be indifferent to the changes in the environment, many of which are caused by man. He talks about global warming. 2015, the warmest year on record. 2016, likely even more so. He mentioned the severe droughts, floods, fires, extreme weather events. And the Pope said, when we mistreat nature, we also mistreat human beings. But he highlighted throughout the document the common thread was our responsibility for God's creation. But here's what the Pope proposed. Concrete ways of thinking and acting that are more respectful of creation. For example, avoiding the use of plastic and paper, reducing water consumption, separating refuse, cooking only what can be reasonably consumed, showing care for other living beings, using public transport or carpooling, planting trees, turning off unnecessary lights, or any number of other practices.
And then, of course, on Monday, he met with the founder of Facebook.
He did. He met with Zuckerberg and also his wife. Zuckerberg's wife was in town, Priscilla Chan. They met in an audience, and it's interesting because the press office statement was very brief, and it said that the Pope and Zuckerberg spoke of how to use communication technologies to alleviate poverty, encourage a culture of encounter, and deliver a message of hope, especially to the people most disadvantaged. And of course, I went right away to Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook page. And that's where you got more information on the encounter, right. He said that he and his wife Priscilla had the honor of meeting Pope Francis at the Vatican. We told him how much we admire his message of mercy and tenderness and how he's found new ways to communicate with people of every faith around the world. We also discussed the importance of connecting people, especially in parts of the world without internet. Zuckerberg gave the Pope, and he mentions it, we gave him a model of Aguila, which means eagle, our solar-powered aircraft that will beam internet connectivity to places that don't have it. And he said it was a meeting we'll never forget. You can feel the Pope's warmth and kindness and how deeply he cares about helping people. Now, there is a little P.S. to this piece of news, because yesterday, spacecraft carrying the satellite, Aquila, that was supposed to do this for Facebook, it did explode at Cape Canaveral. We did learn later in the day that Zuckerberg is donating $500,000 to the victims of the earthquake and the towns involved.
So let's take a look at the general audience on Wednesday.
The previous week was the day of the earthquake, so the Pope had, instead of his catechesis, had said the rosary with the faithful in St. Peter's Square. And this Wednesday, the Pope focused on another catechesis, of course, for the Holy Year of Mercy, and he focused on Jesus' cure of the woman suffering from hemorrhages and how she trusted in Jesus' mercy and saving power to free her from her illness. And I learned something. I never had anybody explain this to me. The Pope said, filled with deep faith, she reached out and touched his garment. And the Pope explained that in Hebrew religious tradition, wearing such a garment was a symbol of being clothed with the divine law, a source of blessing. So the woman's gesture of touching his garment is a form of quiet prayer and a sign of hope. How many times have I read and heard that gospel, etc., and I never knew the symbolism of the touching of the garment. But actually, probably the highlight of Wednesday was the creation of a new dicastery in the Vatican. We knew a number of dicasteries were pontifical councils, as they had been called and will be until January 1st.
Will be merging.
They will be merging in what the Holy Father right now is simply calling a dicastery. He's not calling it a congregation or a pontifical council. The councils for migrants, peace and justice, health workers and charity, that would have been Cor Unum, were all put under one roof, and that is just a continuation of Pope Francis's multi-year reform of the Vatican bureaucracy to make it more streamlined. The Holy Father named Cardinal Peter Turkson to lead the department as prefect, and of course, the Cardinal right now heads the Justice and Peace Council.
Also Wednesday, there was a conference of cardiologists.
35,000 cardiologists from all over the world gathered at Rome's fairgrounds, and the Pope went and addressed them. I mean, that was the only place that they could meet, was on Rome's fairgrounds. It was actually sponsored by a European Congress of cardiology. But they've been meeting since the 27th and researching to explore the role of teamwork in researching, diagnosing, and treating cardiovascular illnesses. And so he spoke to them on the final day of their convention and reaffirmed the Church's constant support for and recognition of the importance of scientific research and care for the scientists who carry it out. And he said, nature in all its complexity and the human mind are created by God. Their richness must be studied by skilled men and women in the knowledge that the advancement of the philosophical and empirical sciences, as well as professional care in favor of the weakest and most infirm, is a service that is part of God's plan. So integral to their work is the human dignity of man.
There to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. And I'm Tracy McClure. Thank you for joining me today. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's Vatican Weekend. Check out this and more stories on our website. You'll find us on rv.va and click on the English icon. Laudator Jesus Christus.